Please be seated. Good morning. We want to welcome the Valley Christian School students. Would they please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here with a program entitled Court with Class. The State Bar and the Supreme Court invite students across the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the students accept the invitation, then they come, they hear an oral argument after they've had the benefit of reading materials that we have sent you about the case. And then at noon, a justice is assigned to speak with the students, describing the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues arising in these cases. And everyone is welcome, not only the students, but counsel and anyone who wishes to attend. This has been a national award-winning program, and by now thousands of students across the state have come to this court. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to his left, Justice Pat Rogensack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I should have told you that Justice Rogensack is the justice with whom you'll meet after this oral argument. And you probably will be joined by students from the Central Wisconsin Christian School. And if my informal introduction of Justice Rogensack by using the name Pat instead of Patience would bother anyone, I've been asked to do that. So with that, I'll call our case 09-AT-2422-CR, State versus David W. Domke. Arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General Marguerite M. Moeller. You may proceed, counsel.
Your Honor, may it please the court. This matter is here on the state's petition to review a decision of the Court of Appeals which reversed David Domke's conviction for repeated sexual assault of the same child, his stepdaughter, Alicia. The Court of Appeals rejected in a footnote two of Domke's claims of ineffective assistance. And those two claims are not being raised in this court. However, the evidence surrounding those claims will be important in the state's contention that Domke was not prejudiced under Strickland versus Washington by the two deficiencies that the Court of Appeals perceived in defense counsel's performance. Specifically, the Court of Appeals found no deficient performance in counsel's failure to object to the testimony of Lauren Hall, who was a 12-year-old friend of the victim, and found no deficiency in counsel's decision to introduce a report that was prepared by physician's assistant Tracy Buffet. What the Court of Appeals found, however, was that counsel was deficient in failing to interpose a hearsay objection to the testimony of a therapist named Kim Rush, which the Court of Appeals found would have precluded Rush from testifying at all. And the Court of Appeals further found that counsel was deficient in deciding to call Alicia's mother, Tina Domke, as a defense witness. Although the Court of Appeals did not find that either one of these perceived deficiencies in and of itself was prejudicial under Strickland versus Washington, the court found that the collective prejudice of calling Tina Domke and allowing Kim Rush to testify required that David Domke be given a new trial. The state's position is that the failure to object to Kim Rush's testimony was not deficient performance because, contrary to the Court of Appeals decision, an objection most certainly would not have kept out all of Kim Rush's testimony, and because it was not really, it was reasonable for counsel to believe that the portion of Kim Rush's testimony in which she recounted very generally what Alicia had told her would be admissible under the hearsay exception for statements made for purposes of medical diagnosis or treatment. Now, in advancing the argument that counsel's belief that those statements were admissible through Kim Rush, the state is not asking this court to overrule its holding in State versus Huntington, where the court found that statements made to a social worker or a counselor did not qualify under that hearsay exception 908.03 sub 4. The state's argument is simply that counsel's belief that Alicia's statements to Kim Rush, which were undeniably made in the course of therapy, where Kim Rush had seen Alicia on 20 to 25 occasions as a patient, that counsel could reasonably believe that those statements did in fact fall within this hearsay exception and declined to object on hearsay grounds as a result of that entirely reasonable belief.
It may be a reasonable belief. Does that mean the state thinks that the trial court would have been correct in overruling or allowing this evidence in, this testimony in, had an objection be made under hearsay? Is this a medical, in other words, does it fall under the exception? Is it a medical, for medical treatment?
It doesn't have to be medical treatment because this court in State versus Nelson held back in the 1980s that statements that were made to a psychologist, which were obviously for purposes of mental health treatment, did fall within that hearsay exception. And that is one of the reasons why the state is arguing that counsel's belief that these statements similarly fell within that exception was reasonable. In other words, the ultimate question is not whether had the objection been made, would the trial court have sustained or overruled the objection, but whether counsel's belief was reasonable and whether that belief fell within what's called the wide range of professionally competent assistance.
Let me ask it differently. If counsel didn't think this was good evidence, in other words, he thought it was hearsay and should have been excluded, was that reasonable too?
If he thought that specifically the portion of the testimony where she's recounting what the girl said,
sure.
If he believed that, that would be reasonable too.
Okay. What's the law?
I think the law is not entirely clear. I think that at first blush, and personally in my Court of Appeals brief, I fell into this trap. I believed that under Huntington, statements that were made to Kim Rush, where she actually told what had happened to her, would have been inadmissible.
Inadmissible. Right.
But upon looking more closely at the Huntington decision and looking at the holding in light of the facts there, I think it is debatable whether the statements that Alicia made to Kim Rush would come within the exception. In Huntington, the person to whom the statements were made was a tribal counselor who was also a social worker. Her name was Lori Carter Bell. Statements to Ms. Bell were not made for the purpose of Ms. Bell treating the victim in Huntington, but merely for her to give a referral to another person who would then become the treating professional. So that is very different than the factual underpinnings here, where Kim Rush had an ongoing treatment relationship with Alicia. She was meeting with her to help get to the root of her problems, having nightmares, feeling scared all the time, talking about what was causing those feelings to surface. So I think on that basis, Huntington is distinguishable. Moreover, Kim Rush doesn't fall neatly into the category of either social worker or counselor, which were the two classes of treating professionals this court in Huntington identified as not falling within that hearsay exception. There's no question but that Kim Rush is not a social worker, even though the Court of Appeals, in its decision, incorrectly identified her as a social worker. She described herself as an outpatient therapist, and she holds a bachelor's degree in psychology. Now, admittedly, having a bachelor's degree in psychology, which I personally have, doesn't make you a psychologist.
You better prepare for Daubert.
That's exactly
I wouldn't want to even go there with Daubert, but...
Sorry to have interrupted you. Go ahead, counsel.
But
bachelor's degree doesn't prepare you, right?
Right, exactly. So the fact that she had a BA in psychology does make her somewhat more similar to the treating professional in State versus Nelson who was a psychologist. And also she had an emphasis in community counseling. So on the defense side, the defense could probably say, well, she had an emphasis in community counseling. That makes her more like a counselor, which is one of the classes identified in Huntington. So I think it really was debatable as to whether or not Huntington would, in fact, preclude the testimony of Kim Rush insofar as she recounted what Alicia told her.
Counsel?
Justice Bradley?
Counsel, recently I went to a seminar given by Professor Blinka on Daubert, just as the Chief mentioned Daubert, and he indicated that some prosecutors were concerned because what people that they in the past had used as witnesses in sexual assault, primarily child sexual assault cases, will no longer qualified as witnesses. Do you have an opinion with regard to this particular witness, Kim Rush, whether or not she would qualify under the Daubert standard?
Well, is this a Daubert?
Off the top of my head, I don't have an opinion on that, but in terms of what her function was here, she was not really testifying as an expert to give an opinion on whether this child manifested the symptoms that are commonly associated with a person who's been sexually assaulted. I think, just off the top of my head, I think under Daubert she probably still would qualify had she been called for that purpose, because her lengthy experience would have given...
If she qualified under Huntington, you wouldn't think Daubert would present any problem. Is that correct?
I'm not sure. If you're saying if her testimony was inadmissible under Huntington, could she...
No. If it was okay under Huntington, you don't think that it would present any problem in a Daubert-type case because of the nature of her testimony?
No, I think there's two different questions, though. I mean, one goes to what is she allowed to say in terms of relating what the child told her, as opposed to does she have the credentials to qualify as an expert? And really, that second question isn't at issue in this appeal.
Counsel, somewhere in the briefs, there's reference to Exhibit 1, which I thought was an exhibit based on a report prepared by Kim Rush.
That's correct. Exhibit 1 was a report prepared by Kim Rush. I believe that it's in the record, and it was admitted. However, there's no indication that that exhibit was ever published to the jury, that the jury actually looked at the exhibit, nor is there any indication that any exhibits went to the jury during deliberations. I specifically reread that portion of the transcript yesterday in terms of submitting the case to the jury. And from what I could determine, it looked like the only documents that went to the jury were copies of the jury instructions and the verdict forms. It did not appear that any of those exhibits went into the jury room.
So the Kim Rush report, Exhibit 1, is different from the Tracy Buffet report?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. Tracy Buffet's report was admitted by defense counsel, and that earlier had been the subject of a claim of ineffective assistance, but that claim is not before the court at this level.
Who introduced Exhibit 1?
The prosecutor. And I believe it came in without objection, but the prosecutor was the one. He had, first of all, used Exhibit 1 in his examination of the victim, Alicia, in this case. And then when Kim Rush testified, she identified it as her report that she had generated, and it was admitted as an exhibit at trial.
So Exhibit 1 was in the record before Kim Rush testified?
It wasn't admitted. It had been used in the examination of the earlier witness. But in terms of its actual moving into evidence, I believe that that came during the testimony of Ms. Rush.
What I'm really trying to get at, does the existence of Exhibit 1 have any impact on the thinking process of defense counsel vis-a-vis Kim Rush?
I'm not really sure that that was ever explored with him at the Mochner hearing, so it's really hard for me to go back and determine what, you know, he felt in terms of how that helped or hurt the case. What I think is important, though, is to remember that when you look at Kim Rush's testimony, she only testified for about 6 transcript pages, and in that testimony, only 2 of those pages really related to what Alicia had told her. And those, even that testimony was very general. It did not zero in on the specific allegations of what kind of sexual contact she was saying David Domke had committed on her. In contrast, if you look at Tracy Buffet's report, which defense counsel introduced, that was very specific. And in fact, when the prosecutor examined Tracy Buffet, the prosecutor went through the various allegations of the types of sexual contact that Alicia said had occurred. And so her testimony was much more specific than the testimony of Kim Rush in regard to relating what Alicia had told her about what David Domke had done to her. And I think that's very critical because in terms of looking at whether, let's assume that this court were to find that counsel was deficient in the respects that the Court of Appeals found, I don't think there's really any way that the court could find that the admission of Kim Rush's testimony and Tina Domke's testimony undermined confidence in the jury's verdict. If you look at the totality of the circumstances, you start out with a case that was very, very strong from the prosecution's standpoint, because unlike most child sexual assault cases, there was a victim who, at the time of trial, was 12 years old, and she was incredibly, in my opinion, incredibly articulate about what the defendant had done to her. She was willing to stand up to defense counsel and say, I don't remember what I told these various people. That was 2 years ago. So you've got a very strong witness to start with. Then you have the testimony of her friend, Lauren Hall, which was very powerful because Lauren Hall and another girl were the first people to whom the victim disclosed the sexual assault. And that occurred at a sleepover several months after the assaultive behavior started, where this 10-year-old girl, the victim was 10 at the time, told her 2 friends that my stepdad licked me in the privates. And Lauren Hall said it looked like Alicia was going to throw up when she said that. I just found that to be incredibly powerful testimony. And not only that, but Alicia made Lauren Hall and the other friend Jenny swear that they would not tell anybody about this disclosure. And that kind of shoots out of the water any theory that this girl had some sort of agenda or an axe to grind against David Domke, because she didn't want this abuse to become public. And the only way it became public was because Lauren Hall or the other girl told her mother. The mother called somebody at the elementary school that the girls attended, and the elementary school guidance counselor notified the police and social services. And then you had Bonnie Anderson of Social Services and Sergeant Rank from the police department descend upon Alicia without any warning to say, we understand that your stepfather is sexually assaulting you. And Alicia denied it. She lied to a police officer and she lied to Social Services because she was trying to protect the defendant. She didn't want this to come out. She was afraid it would hurt her mother. She was afraid it would break up their family. And she was afraid that David Domke would go to jail. And in fact, all of those things have happened. But the fact that she did not want this disclosed and she had no motive to make up this story, and then you couple it with Lauren Hall's testimony, the defense really had very little to work with in this case, which is why even if you assume that the defense counsel should have said hearsay objection as soon as Kim Rush was saying in general terms what the child had said, that really wasn't going to make any difference or make the jury think that Alicia was lying when she told Kim Rush and when she testified at trial as to these four instances on which David Domke has sexually assaulted her. When the defense attorney was cross-examining Alicia, he tried to make a lot of the fact that she had failed to disclose the abuse as it was ongoing to her mother, because he had the theory that a child would always disclose something like this to her mother. And Alicia said, the reason I didn't was because my mother was married to the man who was molesting me, and I watch television. I watch CSI. I watch Law and Order, and I know what happens. They take the bad guy away, and I didn't want that to happen.
Counsel, one would assume that we took the case to decide an issue of law. And ordinarily, we don't take a case to say if there was error, it was prejudicial or not prejudicial. And Strickland is set concept, okay. So why do you think we took the case? And it seems to me that what this case presents is the first part of Strickland, which we ordinarily don't ever reach, right? What amounts to ineffective assistance of counsel? That is, did they make such an error that it's not what a reasonable lawyer would do, right?
Right.
Okay. And the so it seems to me that the standard has to be at least one thing this court would do would set a standard that would help lawyers.
I'm sorry, a standard of what?
It would help a standard that would help lawyers in trial courts and the Court of Appeals and us to evaluate the conduct of lawyers, right? And a lawyer's conduct doesn't have to be perfect, right? And there's a range of errors they can make. Now, it seems to me that the brief, the non-party brief of the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, raises a legal issue. And they say that they ask us to look at McMahon and Thayer and Maloney, right, to decide what it is. Now, it seems to me your standard is, if the lawyer could reasonably conclude that the law is, and here she could be a witness and wasn't excluded by hearsay. So if the lawyer could reasonably conclude that what the law is, that is okay performance under Strickland.
That's correct. That it would fall within the wide range of professionally competent assistance, and that it wouldn't necessarily be the best custom or the best practice, but as the U.S. Supreme Court recently said in Harrington versus Richter, you have to really be incompetent under prevailing professional norms. Not to say, well, yes, it would have been better had counsel made this argument, because that would have been a better practice, it would have been better custom, but really the standard for meeting the deficient performance prong of Strickland is, as the Supreme Court said in Harrington, it's a very high bar. And I think that this court took the case, I presume, to at least give some guidance to the defense bar on what you're expected to know or not know. And I don't by that mean, of course, a laundry list of, well, you have to know these statutes or you have to know these cases. But I think when you're, as the Court of Appeals and the trial court seem to do, focusing on a single holding in a single case, specifically one holding in State versus Huntington, which in fact dealt with a lot of other legal issues that were a lot more prominent than whether a social worker or a counselor fell within the scope of this hearsay exception, I think you have to look at, for example, factors such as what is the age of the decision you're talking about.
10 years here, right?
And it can go, and that can work either way, I think. If you could have a decision that was so recent, and I think the example I gave in my brief was the Crawford decision. Crawford just totally changed the confrontation law. But if you're at a trial 1 week after Crawford and you didn't realize Crawford had come down because you were so busy prepping witnesses, I don't think that that would necessarily be deficient performance. So, I mean, you could have a case that was so new that lack of knowledge would not be deficient performance. On the other hand, you could have a case that was very old, but it was also an outlier. Maybe it was very different than a whole other series of cases. It's still out there. It hasn't been overruled, but it's been in existence for years and years. It's never been cited for that point of law. And I think under that situation, you could also say counsel might not be guilty of deficient performance because he or she was unaware of that one case.
Let me just say, the amicus brief takes the position that this argument that just because the law is unclear, as they present it, doesn't protect defense counsel, and defense counsel should not be protected against a challenge just because the law is unclear. From the amicus's brief says that counsel may have to argue a matter that's unclear if it favors the defense. And here, the state's position is that the law is under Huntington is unclear as applied to these facts. So what the amicus says is that the standard we should provide, which is troublesome because it's not a clear standard, bright line standard, he says, take out this language in these cases that I about unsettled law that's in Maloney, McMahon, and Thayer. And the standard we should apply is what would an objectively reasonable counsel do under all the circumstances of this case? And when you give me the circumstances of is it recent, is it old, is it an outlier, I think you're adopting the amicus brief. Are you?
No, I'm not really adopting the amicus brief. I'm just pointing out that in terms of looking at a decision, let's say where the decision isn't ambiguous, let's say that the Huntington decision definitely would have excluded
Right.
This testimony.
Which was the state's original position.
That was what I had believed incorrectly in the Court of Appeals. But then I think you look at things like the age of the decision. I think you also look at things like how important to the case of either the prosecution or the defense is the evidence at issue. If you have a situation where, for example, the most important evidence the state has against a defendant is his confession to the crime, and you've got eyewitness testimony, well, the fact that the state might be putting on some other acts evidence and the defense failed to be aware of a decision that might have kept out the other acts evidence, that probably is not deficient performance, because that is not a critical piece of evidence in the whole complex of what the state is putting on.
Except you have to put into that, confessions are not always true, we know that, and eyewitness identification, into some people's mind, is the most inaccurate evidence. So now you're left with other acts.
Right. So I may have given a bad example there if you're looking at those two other categories. But I'm just pointing out that this is, I think, is another factor. You have to look at what role does the evidence at issue play either on behalf of the prosecution to get a conviction or as part of your defense.
Sounds to me as is there an objectively reasonable counsel. You look at all the facts to determine whether there was sufficient protection of his or her client rights. I don't hear you saying something different.
And maybe I'm saying it in a different way, and I just don't realize that. But I personally don't think that this court should retract language saying that if something is unsettled, that counsel still has a duty to raise it.
Counsel, your red light is on, but when you come back for your rebuttal, I would find it helpful to hear your thoughts on the trial counsel's conduct vis-a-vis Tina Domke.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Martha K. Askins, Assistant State Public Defender, representing the defendant, David Domke. Ms. Askins.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Martha Askins, and I represent David Domke. I ask the court to do one of two things, either affirm the Court of Appeals decision or dismiss this case as improvidently granted. And the reason I say the second is that it seems to me that in listening to the state's argument that the focus is really exactly what the Court of Appeals has already done, and that is simply look at under Strickland, was trial counsel deficient, and was there prejudice? And normally this court does not weigh in on questions that are already established. But obviously we're here, and I do have a number of things that I'd like to say. First of all, the state is really focusing on Huntington and really one case. And I would encourage the court to back up and look at this as really a rules of evidence case. I believe the state is asking you to hold that it is objectively reasonable for a criminal defense trial attorney in a serious felony case to not be knowledgeable of the rules of evidence. That it is objectively reasonable, the state would have you rule, to be ignorant of the law or wrong on the law, that it's okay to possibly even spot a case such as Huntington, but not read the entire case. I ask the court to reject that invitation and to state that reasonably prudent criminal defense attorneys in this state must know the rules of evidence, that being ignorant of the law is not an acceptable defense standard in this case. Indeed, in Thiel, this court stated that trial counsel's failure to understand a particular statute and counsel's resulting failure to file a motion pursuant to that statute were deficient as a matter of law. So it wasn't that long ago that this court stated not knowing this statute constituted deficient performance.
Counsel, it seems to me as if you're proposing a very black and white kind of set of rules here that we adopt and put into the opinion of this case. And normally I'm a fan of black and white rules. However, there do seem to be some subtle, there does seem to be some subtle things going on here with Huntington, especially with the interplay of Nelson. If you read Huntington, when you read Huntington, and when you see the reasoning and the rationale behind it, and then certainly in preparation for this case, it prompted my consideration of what I was thinking in my mind as Ms. Rausch, until the pronunciation is elucidated as Rausch. What was she doing here? Does she fit within Huntington?
Right.
And so I'm trying to figure out how it would apply to future rules.
Right.
Could there have been, now is this case the best vehicle to reexamine Huntington? That's certainly debatable. But it does call into question how we should move forward here given those subtleties.
Sure. And I have a couple of responses to that. First of all, Huntington says, I believe, this exception doesn't apply to social workers or counselors.
Right.
So we have that nice language right there. So that's our starting point. So then the question is, well, what is, and I say Rausch, so what is Kim Rausch? Opposing counsel talked about her, how she self-identifies. I would ask the court to completely reject.
She also talked about, I'm not right. being rude, I want to have a conversation. Sure. She also talked about 20 to 25 therapy sessions.
Right.
And then you started to say, and I think you were going there because you started to say the black and white rule from Huntington, but then the basis for that rule, of course, was the whole basis for the statements made for medical diagnosis or treatment are based on the sort of self-interest of the patient in providing honest information, because they know the more honest they are with the healthcare provider, the more efficient and effective the treatment is going to be. And then that started me thinking anyway about, well, could the same be said for therapy and for mental health services and counseling, that the person being treated here, Alicia, sounds like a pretty smart 10 to 12-year-old, reading the trial court's observations and even accorded the trial counsel after the preliminary hearing made the observation of what a powerful witness she was. Would she be aware that, gee, the more truthful I am with this person who appears to be counseling me, regardless of whether she had a bachelor's or whether she was a social worker or what, the more truthful I am with this person who seems to be counseling me and seems to be in the role of someone who's trying to be helpful to me, the more effective the help will be. I don't know what your thoughts would be on it.
Well, a few different thoughts. I wasn't actually going to talk about this selfish treatment motivation. What I was about to say was that the state's attorney talks about how this counselor self-identifies. And I would encourage the court to not go down that path, because, of course, there could be lots of people who self-identify as something that we don't want them to be.
I don't think that was a major part, and I don't think we have too many worries here.
Another couple of points. I think Your Honor's focus on what is the declarant believing is an appropriate one. And that's certainly that goes to the underpinnings of this exception. And that is, does this person believe that it's important to tell the truth in order to get treatment? That's the underpinning. And, of course, in my brief, I talk about how I think that we should be very cautious in applying that in the mental health context as opposed to the physical health context. Because, of course, if this trial had occurred after Alicia had had one session, the testimony would have been nothing happened. So she didn't tell the truth. If the truth is ultimately what happened after the 20th session or whatever it is, she didn't initially tell the truth. So, You know, I've been, of course, we all think about these cases as we're going to be arguing them, and not that long ago I had a kidney stone, and I had a big selfish motivation to tell the doctor what was going on.
I would call it enlightened self-interest.
So that, you know, there's an acute pain going on that's a medical problem. It makes perfect sense to me. But on the other hand, maybe I'm sent to a therapist for marriage counseling or something like that. My self-interest may be very mixed, and I just don't see the reliability that's so strong there. Now, granted, Huntington says it's so, you know, we and Nelson say psychologists we're gonna allow that as an exception. So what I'm suggesting is we should not go any further. Let's limit it to what we now have. I hear the state saying they're not encouraging an overturning of Huntington, and I'm not saying that we need to overturn Nelson. I say but we do draw that line there. Let's not go down the road of who's akin to what. And, you know, maybe it's a little bit arbitrary, but in Nelson, those people had doctor in front of their names. And Ms. Roosh did not, which reminds me that one of my colleagues checked Ms. Roosh's licensing on, you know, the licensing website, and she is a licensed professional counselor, and they describe at length what that is, but I'll just give you a little bit of it. Professional counseling means applying a combination of human development, rehabilitation, and either psychosocial or psychotherapeutic principles, procedures, or services that integrate a wellness pathology and multicultural model of human behavior in order to assist an individual, couple, family, group of individuals, organization, institution, or community to achieve mental, emotional, physical, social, moral, educational, spiritual, vocational, or career development and adjustment through the lifespan of
person. That clears it up.
Exactly. So I guess to step back a little bit, I don't think Huntington is unclear. I think counsel, you know, reading the case would see it, would say, aha, I filed my motion in limine pretrial, and we hash out whether this woman's testimony comes in.
Suppose it's ambiguous, unclear, right?
Suppose Huntington is ambiguous?
In the sense of to whom does it apply? Suppose it's unclear.
Then I think you still make the objection, and I guess this is where maybe your reference to the amicus in during the first part of the argument would come in. If it's arguable, you ought to make the objection. Now, I don't think it is unclear, so, you know, I'm hesitant to go down the road of the amicus brief. I don't think that case is before the court right now.
You think it's clear that at least part of this woman's testimony would have been knocked out?
Yes. And, you know, there's some discussion about parsing her testimony. There would be no reason to call her, in my view, if she's not going to testify that after 20 to 25 sessions, Alicia told me that she'd been sexually assaulted. Why call her otherwise? So I think counsel got a list of witnesses, and Kim Roosh is on there. Counsel can go down that list of witnesses and see Kim Roosh with all the initials after her name. And counsel can go through each of those and say to himself in this case, or maybe to sit down with his client and say, what are these people going to tell me? And reasonably prudent defense attorney, I would submit, would say, how do I limit the damage that this witness is going to do to my client? Or even better, how do I keep this person off the stand? Or, I suppose, is this person helpful to me? But in this case, you see Kim Roosh and you say, How can I keep her off the stand? And the answer is in Huntington. And I wanted to, the reason I have these books on my on the table is that Huntington is in both Fine's Wisconsin evidence and our state bar evidence guide as one of the first annotations in the Brown book, and not just for the other principles of Huntington, but for this one.
To answer your rhetorical question, though, why would you call her? Believe me, I thought, I've been thinking about that, too. And I suppose, even though it would be pretty weak tea, if there was a case where, say, the mother remained unsupportive of Alicia, and stayed with her original position, I suppose it could serve as some corroboration to call Ms. Rush to the stand and say, what do you do for a living? What kind of services do you provide? Did you see Alicia at some point? How many times? I mean, it would be very limited and it would be very weak tea, but I think all of those would still be sort of relevant to the idea. Did somebody in a position to do so think it would was important for Alicia to see?
Well, I think they probably, I mean, I suppose in that limited context, I guess
it
I don't see a hearsay
limited.
Objection.
Right.
It would be of limited relevance, but I guess
because,
it wouldn't be objectionable.
Because you're not going to get 5 minutes rebuttal, I would like to, if you want to talk about trial counsel's conduct in regard to Tina Domke,
right.
I'd find that helpful.
Thank you. I think the Court of Appeals got it exactly right on that, and so I would refer to their decision. The deficiency is there are a couple of layers of deficiency. One is that reasonably prudent trial counsel, I don't believe, would call a witness, particularly maybe the mom of the victim, without talking to her in advance. So what we know from the post-conviction hearing is that Mr. Woods didn't talk to Tina Domke either on the day of trial or the day before trial, and that he knew from talking to his client that mom was, quote, vacillating in her beliefs. So if you're going to call a witness to vouch for your client, you need to talk to that witness. So the deficiency is in A, not investigating what the witness is going to say. Then the second deficiency there goes to, and if the court takes a look at what the trial testimony looks like, Mr. Woods was fumbling a little bit with the questions, and the trial judge invited him to say, you know, ask about your daughter's reputation for truthfulness. But instead, he asked whether she believed her daughter. So he asked a very different question, and, of course, that then opened up the possibility for, on cross-examination, for the question, well, you believe her now.
Taking it piece by piece, the part about talking to the mother before testimony, when I read that in the Court of Appeals and when I think about it, I kind of think, that is not necessarily the panacea in terms of, you know, having tried a fair share of child sexual assault cases, both as in a former life as a prosecutor and presided over them as a trial court. We know what it's like in the dynamics of these things, and they range all over the map. And many, many times the witnesses are simply hostile and they've staked out their position. They don't want to talk to any lawyers, and they especially don't want to talk to lawyers who are going to be adverse to what they view as their interests. So I'm not sure would it have been preferable for trial counsel to have taken an attempt at doing that? Absolutely. But the answer that's deficient performance in and of itself for not having done that, especially when you have the prior statements of mom saying, I don't believe my daughter, I believe my husband. It didn't happen. And then I see that the trial counsel, in an unusual way, did get it out there on the record It did get out anyway on the transcript that at one point mom did not believe her own daughter. So the jury had a chance to hear that here. I know we're kind of getting into the second consideration, which goes to the overall prejudice, the cumulative prejudice. But I'm not sure that that in it, what would your response to that be?
Well, initially it's that she wasn't supposed to be an adverse witness. I recognize that at a trial, indeed at a Mochner hearing, one never quite knows what a witness is going to say. And certainly in these highly charged cases, you know, we all recognize that witnesses will say things that people don't anticipate. But she was his witness. And so I would say that you don't call a witness who is your own witness if you're not sure what she's going to say, especially when he had some information that she had a change of heart. And Mr. Woods explained at the post-conviction hearing a little bit more why he thought Mrs. Domke had changed her mind about it, and it was actually incredibly damaging. I mean, he was saying that the reason she had changed her mind was that she was afraid if she didn't take her daughter's side that the ex-husband was going to use that in terms of a custody challenge. So if, you know, if we take Mr. Woods's thinking about, well, why she changed her mind, and he knew there was this animosity between the two parents, I'm thinking that it was even worse idea to call this witness.
Does the record show, and I simply don't remember, mm-hmm. does the record show when the most point recent in time prior to the trial defense counsel had spoken to Tina Domke?
He did not, in the post-conviction hearing transcript, it is unclear. He did not recall ever speaking with Tina Domke. He said he relied on her statements in the police reports and what he heard from his client. But he was unclear. I think he said he didn't recall if he had ever. On page 31, I've noted of the post-conviction hearing, he didn't talk to her on the day of trial or the day before. He may never have spoken with her. So we don't know if he ever spoke to her. The record's not crystal clear on that.
And then as you were starting to get into the transcript in regard to the answers about how he sort of stumbled into, yes, I believe her 100%.
Right.
So please continue.
Well, did you want me to talk a little bit more about that? Or you were, I
wanted you to have the opportunity to the extent you wanted
okay.
to talk about
it. No, you know, I think I've covered Tina Domke. I think it was with the understanding that one never is sure exactly what a witness will say when one is calling somebody like the mother of an alleged victim, reasonably prudent counsel should have an idea of what that witness is going to say.
Counsel, what rule of law is worthy of coming out of this case that will help defense counsel and the state and courts? I mean, that's why we take cases mm-hmm. when the law is unclear. One would be, we're going to clean up, if it needs to be cleaned up, Huntington, right? That's one thing. But that's not really what everybody is arguing. Two, we don't say anything about the standard for any ineffective counseling, ineffective lawyer. We just say, hey, we go right to prejudice and then say there was or wasn't prejudice. If we say there was prejudice, then we have to go back and see if there was ineffective, right? So what rule of law do we come out of this?
I think that the rule of law that comes out of this could be one of two things. First, we reaffirm Strickland and Pitch and Thiel.
We don't have any choice, right?
Yeah,
Strickland
exactly.
is a federal law.
Right.
Unless we're going to go in on our own state constitution, we're going to affirm.
But the court says
we're
happy with that. And Strickland, you know, rejected the idea of guidelines and said that that was really going to increase the number of ineffective assistance counsel claims, because if the court starts saying, well, the age of the case is important, or, you know, counsel must do A, B, and C, then people like me will be looking for A, B, and C, and if they're not there, then it's, you know, you check the box and it's ineffective. What Strickland, you know, and I think Strickland recognized that. So, you know, I think the court could take the opportunity to say, we've been invited to apply guidelines or some sort of rules. We declined to do that. We're happy with Pitch and Thiel. We reinvigorate our previous holdings, and we're not going to give, you know, other kinds of criteria. Or the court could say, if the court feels like some more guidance needs to be given, is to say, we expect a reasonably prudent criminal defense attorney will be fully knowledgeable about the rules of evidence. And the reason I keep going back to the rules of evidence is, if counsel simply hears hearsay and objects, the state must then say why it comes in. And so it shifts that burden over to the state to articulate, why is this evidence admissible? So really, counsel, you know, the finer points of what cases might be, I think the court should say, we'll still do that on a case-by-case analysis, but we expect trial counsel who tries a criminal case to know to object when you hear hearsay.
Counsel, one of the things that concerns me during this whole case is, should the standard of care be any different in a civil case for, I'll use the term, deficient performance, sometimes we call it malpractice, than in a criminal case? You say the standard is, we expect reasonably prudent criminal defense attorneys will be knowledgeable about the rules of evidence. That almost causes me to choke. That's not asking a lot. Just like I would expect if I were a civil litigant, I would expect my attorney to be reasonably knowledgeable about the rules of evidence. And if I have an attorney that's not reasonable, and I say reasonable, it's reasonable under the circumstances, exercising ordinary care under the circumstances. And then, of course, you have to determine what the circumstances are.
The reason I say that, Your Honor, is that I think what the state is asking for is that counsel need not know the rules of evidence. That's why I put the bar that low, and I'm asking that the court not set it any lower than that. I think
criminal defense attorneys in felony cases have attorneys who are held to a lower standard than attorneys in civil cases?
To tell you the truth, Your Honor, I just am not familiar with what the standards would be in a civil malpractice case. So I'm afraid I can't answer that. But I can say in the, you know, the Strickland standard is the objective standard of reasonableness. And I think, and I would encourage the court to look at the entirety of the trial, at least the first day, and look for itself to see whether it felt that trial counsel here, you know, performed to that objective standard of reasonableness.
Did counsel know anything about the Huntington case?
In his post-conviction testimony, he was very unclear about how this evidence would come in, and his sort of fallback position was this was records of regularly conducted activity. Anything that's a record would come in. And he never was clear that he thought it was even hearsay. In fact, at one point when it came to asking about Kim Rouche, he said at page 21 of the post-conviction hearing transcript that he was not absolutely sure Alicia's statements to Rouche were hearsay. He didn't object because there were written records on this regularly kept. Did I answer your question? Because I see my time is almost up. There are a couple of other little things.
Could I ask one other? Hit the dream question.
Yeah, that was where I was going to go. That, I think, is another layer of deficiency. You know, when we think about deficient performance, it's so easy to say, well, the deficiency is in not objecting and in asking this question. But I think as Your Honor wrote in Thiel and in, you know, other cases, these things are layered. So they really start with, did I investigate, you know, in Pitch, for example? Did I do the necessary investigation? Well, that might be deficiency number one. And secondly, then that leads to my ignorance of the law, leads to I don't make that motion or I don't make that objection. So I think I would just urge the court to look at what the Court of Appeals said about the dream question.
I mean, isn't that the kind of question that's only deficient in hindsight? I mean, the typical answer would be reading transcripts, conducting trials, anything, you would know that the typical anyone reading this would have guessed that the response would be anything's possible.
Well, I think that a reasonably prudent criminal defense attorney would have some basis for asking that question. And he doesn't know what the answer is going to be. He's hoping for anything is possible. Why not simply, well, this is getting down to maybe what the best practice is. But, of course, what we learn in trial advocacy is you don't ask that last question. You argue that to the jury. So when Alicia says, I was asleep, why not simply argue to the jury, this might have been a dream? But that's kind of getting a little bit off the point. What I think is true is what the Court of Appeals said, which is no objectively reasonable attorney would conclude that a therapist who spent 20 to 25 sessions with a child would testify that she had dreamed of one of the assaults, that just wasn't, you know, hindsight notwithstanding, that was not a reasonable question.
Well, or it could equally be argued that it wasn't a reasonable answer.
Oh, well. Now, my time is up.
Yes, it is.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any, does anyone have any questions? Do you want a couple of minutes to summarize very quickly your position?
No, I think my position has been summarized. What I was going to do was talk about something new, which was prejudice, and I don't want to overstep.
But you stand on your brief on prejudice, I assume.
I did have a couple more things to say about it, but yes, I'll stand on it.
Smoller?
How can you justify the dream question?
I would justify the dream question by saying that when you have very little to work with in a case, sometimes you are forced to grasp at straws. And I think that that's what Attorney Woods was confronting here. I mean, if you look at his overall strategy in the case, it appeared to be that he was looking at ways to sow doubt in the jury's mind. He did it primarily by saying that Alicia's statements to various people were inconsistent. He hammered away at inconsistencies. He said she lied to the first people who came to investigate the assault. Then she finally said she had been assaulted on two occasions. And finally at trial she testified it was four, and she had told apparently her therapist that it was four. So the theory of the defense was only to sow doubt in various ways. Another way Woods did this was by calling all of David Domke's children, his natural children, and his ex-wife, Tina Baxter, to testify that he had never sexually assaulted any of his other children, and none of them had ever seen any kind of inappropriate behavior on the part of Domke towards Alicia. So I think even though this question might not have been the best question in some cases, when you don't have a lot to work with, when you're given a case where the prosecution has a great witness, great corroboration by the testimony of the first child to whom the victim disclosed the abuse, no motive whatsoever for falsely accusing David Domke, then you have to take a little more risk than you might have in the typical case. And the trial court recognized this. The trial judge found that asking the dream question was within a reasonable strategy, that it backfired, but nevertheless, it was a reasonable strategy. It was only the Court of Appeals that found otherwise.
Did that question apply to anything more than the first offense?
I believe it only applied to the one where Alicia had said she was asleep, and then she woke up to hear the ice maker, and the defense attorney tried to point out, well, if you woke up, wasn't that a dream, that kind of thing. So I think it only applied to that particular offense.
Opposing counsel makes a pretty good point. There were 20 to 25 therapy sessions. How could counsel expect a different answer, particularly when the risk of asking the question only applied to one of the four offenses?
That's correct. But I think sometimes in cross-examination, you ask the question just to get that idea out to the jury that maybe this was a dream based on everything she was saying. I mean, a lot of times when a defense attorney is cross-examining a sexual assault victim about something like prior false allegations, that victim might keep saying, no, I never said this, and might keep denying it, but yet, just by virtue of asking the question, it gets it out in front of the jury and creates, or hopefully on the part of the defense attorney, creates doubt in the minds of the jury. So I don't think that asking that question, even though there was very little chance that Kim Rush was going to say, yes, I thought it might be a dream, I don't think asking the question amounted to deficient performance. Before I forget, I want to address Justice Gableman's question at the close of my presentation regarding the decision to call Tina Domke as a witness. Both the trial court and the Court of Appeals found that that was deficient performance because counsel had not interviewed Tina Domke before making that decision. And, in fact, David Domke had told counsel that his wife was vacillating about whether she believed Alicia. And we did not argue in our brief that this decision was okay. Rather, I think the focus should be on the prejudice prong of Strickland because it shouldn't come as a surprise to juries or to a jury that a mother believes that her daughter is telling the truth, especially when it was clear from other testimony in the case that now David Domke and Tina Domke were separated and were going to be undergoing a divorce pretty soon.
If I may. If you say it boils down to prejudice, isn't a prejudice determination just an error correction?
Yes, if you're talking...
Why would we take the case if it's just error correction, if it boils down to prejudice?
Well, I would hope that the case was taken with the first allegation of deficient performance that related to the failure to understand one of the holdings in Huntington, or the failure to object on hearsay grounds. This is an alternative reason why the Court of Appeals found that Domke would get a new trial. So obviously, even if the state were to prevail on the first issue of ineffective assistance, we still have to convince the court that the second instance that the Court of Appeals found ineffective assistance, that the court was wrong there. So I think the second finding of ineffective assistance, that particular allegation doesn't really present any earth-shattering questions of law. However, I think the first one related to Kim Rush does present more legal questions, including the whole idea, and this goes back to the question of asking about could this have been a dream. When you're looking at something that counsel has said was strategic, that it wasn't something that was inadvertent, I mean, he planned to ask that question, don't you have to look at what other kinds of defenses or options were available so that a decision to do something in one case might be deficient performance because you had alternative, very substantial grounds for a defense? But in a case where, this case I would call, you know, just, it was a loser from a defense perspective because of all the reasons that I laid out in my brief, then sometimes you do have to go for broke and take the chance that you ask a question you might not know the answer to. Thank you.
I'm still looking for a standard that the court wants, that the state wants us to adopt in this case, relating to the first issue of what does counsel have to do? What does reasonable counsel have to do?
Well, I think it's difficult. It's difficult to be particularly, when you say a standard, like the my opponent said you have to understand the rules of evidence. That's particularly vague, and as applied here, I don't think that if you look at the rule of evidence at issue, the hearsay exception for statements made for purposes of medical diagnosis and treatment, that doesn't answer the question. You have to go to the case law interpreting it. So I think the focus, because this was in fact the focus of both the trial judge and the Court of Appeals, was, hey, counsel didn't know about the Huntington decision. And I think you have to look at that and say, well, is counsel charged with knowing every possible decision that could have an impact on the admissibility of evidence, either in his case or in the state's case, in order to avoid being labeled deficient? And so I think that's where you bring in the factors that I mentioned earlier about,
so
look at the
case. So your test is, should a lawyer in this case reasonably have known about the Huntington decision?
I don't even think it's so much no. I mean, when that's even kind of general, because if you look at the Huntington decision, it covers a lot of ground.
That's right. But as you say, it's ambiguous. So the next question might be, should a lawyer reasonably believe that the Hunting decision is against him and therefore he doesn't have to object to the hearsay evidence, right?
Well, I think that if, instead of just being sort of a one standard, I think it would be more helpful to identify different factors.
When we say, is it reasonable for him to believe, then we're going to look at different factors. It's a 10-year-old case. That could be used either way. It's too old and he forgot it. Right?
So I think you do say, could counsel reasonably believe that this evidence was admissible? I mean, that would be sort of the...
But that's the same thing, and then you get to Huntington. I'm willing to accept it broader. Then you're going to fight about Huntington or whatever other cases are applicable, right, to the hearsay rule.
I think that's part of it, and I also think that you still have to look at how important was the disputed evidence in the greater scheme of things.
That may go to the second prong of prejudice, or it may go to the first prong.
I personally think it would go to both, more to prejudice, but I think it could go to deficient performance,
sure,
because when you're preparing for trial, and depending on how complicated the trial is,
it's a minor thing, you might let the evidence go, because it won't make any difference.
Right.
If it's a major thing, then you have to worry about whether it's good evidence, admissible or not. But isn't that the crux of this case, of trying to put some meat on the Strickland standard in a particular fact situation?
I think so. I mean, I think it's providing guidance to really say, when you talk about when something's an unsettled point of law, and this court has repeatedly said that counsel's not required to raise an objection if something is unsettled, and I think this is a prime example of a situation where, for all the reasons I mentioned, that the admissibility of, and we're only talking about a portion, I think, of Kim Rush's testimony, not the entire testimony, whether that is reasonable.
Which brings me back to the amicus brief, which whole point relates to unclear law. And what should the court be
saying?
I'm
sorry, there's a lot of noise going up here.
Brings us back to the amicus brief, which point is when the law is unclear, what is the standard for the court to set forth, and raises questions about the current standard in Maloney, McMahon, and Thayer.
Right.
But you stand on those cases.
I think that you can't hold counsel to a standard of performance where he or she is expected to raise unsettled points of law. There might be a hypothetical that I haven't thought of right now where maybe there'd be a situation where that's the only way that a defendant could prevail, and at that point, if that's all you got, maybe you have to raise it, but off the top of my head, it doesn't, you know.
But that point would even cover settled law, because if you have to unsettle the law, then maybe that's what you have to do to be a reasonable lawyer. Maybe.
I think that would be more a question of best practices as opposed to something that the U.S. Supreme Court would find could constitute deficient performance. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank two frequent visitors to this court, representing the state on the one hand, Ms. Moeller, and representing defendants, Ms. Askins, and for their usual clear and good job in presenting the issues for their respective clients. That concludes our hearing in 09-AP-2422-CR, State versus Domke. The court is in recess until 1:30, we're not coming back at 1:30. This is it. But we are in recess until tomorrow when we have open administrative conference, and Friday we will have another set of oral arguments. We are in recess. The court will meet in the conference room.